all outward appearances, exempt from any kind of Eighth Amendment protest or sniveling calls home to parents, insidiously, since they can be described to parents and police alike as just drills, assigned for your overall cardiovascular benefit, with all the actual sadism completely sub rosa.
215.
Kitten Plan's prediction that the upperclassmen are going to wear the whole brown helmet for the eschaton free-for-all is hopefully rebuttable by Pemulus's observation that eschaton's extracurricular impulse and structure had been firmly in place before any of them even enrolled. All Michael Pemulus had done was codify basic principles and impose a sort of matrix of decidable strategy. Maybe helped create a mythology and established, mostly through personal example, a certain level of expectation. All Hal'd done was act as amanuensis on a lousy manual. The Interdependence Day combatants had been out there of their own volition. Pemulus and Axford had gotten Hal to write out most of all this in a maximally rhetorical diction, which Pemulus had then embedded in a pink sub 2 printout so he could carry it around and study it and have it all nailed down before Tavis tried any boom lowering. The strategy is to let Pemulus do all the talking, but let Hal interject at will, the voice of reason. Good cop, bad. Axford's been instructed to count the antron fibers between his shoes the whole time they're in there. Hal has no idea what it might signify that the headmaster's summons hasn't come for almost 48 hours. It might be odd that it hadn't once occurred to him to see Tavis personally, or to go to the headmaster's house and ask the moms for intercession or info. It's not like he had the urge but resisted it. It hadn't even occurred to him. For somebody who not only lives on the same institutional grounds as his family, but also has his training and education and pretty much his whole overall raison d'etre directly overseen by relatives, Hal devotes an unusually small part of his brain and time ever thinking about people in his family qua family members. Sometimes when he'll be chatting with somebody in the endless registration line for a tournament, or at a post-meet dance or something, and somebody'll say something like, "How's Avril getting along?" Or, "I saw Oren kicking the ever-living shit out of the ball on an ONANFL highlights cartridge last week." There will be this odd tense moment where Hal's mind will go utterly blank and his mouth slack and flabby, working soundlessly, as if the names were words on the tip of his tongue. Except for Mario, about whom Hal will talk your ear off, it's almost like some ponderous creaky machine has to get up and running for Hal even to think about members of his immediate family as standing in relation to himself. It's a possible reason Hal avoids Dr. Dolores Rusk, who always wants to probe him on issues of space and self-definition, and something she keeps calling the Coatlicue complex.
216.
Hal's maternal half-uncle, Charles Tavis, is a little like the late himself in that Tavis's CV is a back-and-forth but not indecisive mix of athletics and hard science. ABA and doctorate in engineering. An MBA in athletics administration. In his professional youth, Tavis had put them together as a civil engineer. His specialty, the accommodation of stress through patterned dispersal, i.e. distributing the weight of gargantuan athletic spectatorial crowds, i.e., he'd say, he'd handled large live audiences. He'd been, in his own small way, a minor pioneer in polymer-reinforced cement and mobile fulcra. He'd been on design teams for stadia and civic centers and grandstands and micrological-looking superdomes. He'd admit up front that he'd been a far better team player engineer than out there up front stage center in the architectural limelight. He'd apologize profusely when you had no idea what that sentence meant, and say maybe the obfuscation had been unconsciously deliberate, out of some kind of embarrassment over his first and last limelighted architectural supervision up in Ontario, before the rise of ONANite interdependence, when he designed the Toronto Blue Jays novel and much ballyhooed Sky Dome ballpark and hotel complex. Because Tavis had been the one to take the lion's share of the heat when it turned out that Blue Jays spectators in the stands, many of them innocent children wearing caps and pounding their little fists into the gloves they'd brought with hopes of nothing more exotic than a speared foul ball, that spectators at a distressing number of different points all along both foul lines could see right into the windows of guests having various and sometimes exotic sex in the hotel bedrooms over the center field wall. The bulk of the call for Tavis's rolling head had come, he'd tell you, when the cameraman in charge of the Sky Dome's instant replay video scoreboard, disgruntled or professionally suicidal, or both, started training his camera on the bedroom windows and routing the resultant multi-limbed coital images up onto the 75-meter scoreboard, screen, etc., sometimes in slow motion, and with multiple replays, etc. Tavis will admit his reluctance to talk about it still after all this time. He'll confess that his usual former career summary is to say just that he'd specialized in athletic venues that could safely and comfortably seat enormous numbers of live spectators, and that the market for his services had bottomed out as more and more events were designed for cartridge dissemination and private home viewing, which, he'll point out, is not technically untrue so much as just not entirely open and forthcoming. Lateral Alice Moore is printing out Whataburger RSVPs. The Intel 972 is cutting edge, but she clings to a hideous, old, dot matrix printer she refuses to replace, as long as Dave Hardy can keep it going. It's the same with the intercom system and its antiquated iron stand-up mic that Trolch says is an affront to the whole broadcasting profession. Lateral Alice has queer, eccentric pockets of intransigence and Ludditism, due possibly to her helicopter crash and neurologic deficits. The printer's needly sound fills the waiting room. Hal finds he can be confident of his face's symmetry and saliva only when he sits there with his right hand over his left cheek. Each line of Alice's printed response sounds like some sort of supposedly unrippable fabric getting ripped over and over, a dental and life-denying sound. For Hal, the general deal with his maternal uncle is that Tavis is terribly shy around people and tries to hide it by being very open and expansive and wordy and bluff, and that it's excruciating to be around. Mario's way of looking at it is that Tavis is very open and expansive and wordy, but so clearly uses these qualities as a kind of protective shield that it betrays a frightened vulnerability, almost impossible not to feel for. Either way, the unsettling thing about Charles Tavis is that he's possibly the openest man of all time. Oren, in Marlon Bain's view, was always that CT was less like a person than like a sort of cross-section of a person. Even the moms, Hal could remember, relating anecdotes about how as a teenager, when she'd taken the child CT or been around him at Quebecois functions or gatherings involving other kids, the child CT had been too self-conscious and awkward to join right in with any group of the kids clustered around, talking or plotting or whatever. And so Avril said she'd watched him just kind of drift from cluster to cluster and lurk around creepily on the fringe, listening, but that he'd always say loudly, in some lull in the group's conversation, something like, "I'm afraid I'm far too self-conscious really to join in here, so I'm just going to lurk creepily at the fringe and listen, if that's all right, just so you know," and so on. But so the point is that Tavis is an odd and delicate specimen, both ineffectual and in certain ways fearsome as a headmaster, and being a relative guarantees no special predictive insight or quarter, unless certain maternal connections are exploited, the thought of doing which literally does not occur to Hal. This odd blankness about his family might be one way to manage a life where domestic and vocational authorities sort of bleed into each other. Hal squeezes his tennis ball like a madman, sitting there in the needly printout noise, right palm against his left cheek, an elbow hiding his mouth, wanting very much to go first to the pump room, and then to brush vigorously with his portable collapsible Oral-B. A quick chew of Kodiak is out of the question for several reasons. The only other time this year that Hal was officially summoned to the headmaster's waiting room had been in late August, right before convocation and during orientation period, when YDAU's new kids were coming in and wandering around clueless and terrified, etc. And Tavis had wanted Hal to take temporary charge of a 9-year-old kid coming in from somewhere called Philo, Illinois, who was allegedly blind, the kid, and apparently had cranium issues. From having originally been one of the infantile natives of Ticonderoga, New York, evacuated too late, and had several eyes and various stages of evolutionary development in his head, but was legally blind, but still an extremely solid player, which is all kind of a long tale in itself, given that his skull was apparently the consistency of a Chesapeake crab shell. But the head itself was so huge, it made Boo Boo look microcephalic, and the kid apparently had on-court use of only one hand, because the other had to pull around beside him a kind of rolling IV stand appliance with a halo-shaped metal brace welded to it at head height to encircle and support his head. But anyway, Tex Watson and Thorpe had broken CT down over the kid's admission and tuition waiver. And CT now figured the kid would need, to say the least, some extra help getting oriented, literally, and he wanted Hal to be the one to take him in hand, again, literally. It turned out a couple days later that the kid had some kind of either family or cerebrospinal fluid crisis at home in rural Illinois and wasn't matriculating now till the spring term. But back in August, Hal had sat in the very chair Trevor Axford is now nodding off in, very late in the day, like dusk, having had an informal exhibition match with a visiting Latvian satellite pro go an encouraging 3 sets. So that he'd missed Mrs. C's stuffed peppers at supper, his stomach making those where's the food noises from around the transverse colon, alone in the blue room, waiting and chair bobbing reflexively with lateral Alice Morgan home to her long apartment with rooms only 2 meters wide in Newton, and an opaque plastic dust thing wrapped tight over her Intel processor and intercom console, and the little red danger light on her danger third rail plaque unlit, and the only lights besides the weak dusk outside were the hot 105 watts of his chairback's creepy, blue-shaded magazine lamp, plus the multiple lamps on in Charles Tavis's office. Tavis has a phobic thing about overhead lighting, as Tavis was doing a late-day intake interview on impossibly tiny little Tina Echt, who just matriculated this fall at age 7. His doors were open because it was a brutal August, and D.V. Hardy had somehow rigged lateral Alice's air conditioner vent in the waiting room so it really put out. Tavis's office's outer door opened out, while the inner door opened in, which gave his little inter-door vestibule kind of a jaw-like quality when exposed. August YDAU had been when Hal's chronic left ankle had been almost the worst it's ever been, after an irrumpent but grueling summer tour of getting to at least the quarters of just about everything, mostly on hard asphalt.
217.
And he could feel his pulse in the vessels and the raw ligaments of the ankle as he sat flipping the shiny pages of a new world tennis and watching the little ad cards fall out and flutter. But he also couldn't help exploiting the open-jawed view of a substantial section of Charles Tavis at his office desk, looking as usual, oddly foreshortened and small, and with his hands together on the massive desktop across from a partial profile view of a girl, who looked like she couldn't be much more than 5 or 6, preparing to receive intake papers as she listened to Tavis. There'd been no Echt parents or guardians anywhere in view. Some kids just get dropped off. Sometimes the parents' cars barely even stop, just slow down, throw gravel as they accelerate away. Tavis's desk drawers have squeaky casters. Jim Strux folks, Lincoln, hadn't even much slowed. Strzok had been helped to his feet and taken immediately to the locker room to shower the gravel out of his hair. Hal had been in charge of his orientation, too, when Strzok transferred, booted out of Palmer Academy after his pet tarantula, named Simone, another long story, escaped and wouldn't even have dreamed of biting the headmaster's wife if she hadn't screamed and passed out and fallen right on it, Strzok explained as Hal helped pick up suitcases tumbled all over the drive. Like many gifted bureaucrats, Hal's mother's adoptive brother Charles Tavis is physically small in a way that seems less endocrine than perspectival. His smallness resembles the smallness of something that's farther away from you than it wants to be, plus is receding.
218.
This weird appearance of recessive drift, together with the compulsive hand movements that followed his quitting smoking some years back, helped contribute to the quality of perpetual frenzy about the man. A kind of locational panic that it's easy to see explains not only Tavis's compulsive energy, he and Avril, pretty much the dynamic duo of compulsion between them, sleep in their second floor rooms in the headmaster's house, separate rooms, tend to sleep between them, about as much as any one normal insomniac, but maybe also contributes to the pathological openness of his manner. The way he thinks out loud about thinking out loud, a manner Ortho Stites can imitate so eerily, that he's been prohibited by the male 18s from doing his Tavis impression in front of the younger players, for fear that the littler kids will find it impossible to take the real Tavis seriously, at the times he needs to be taken seriously. As for the older kids, Stites can make them all double up now merely by shielding his eyes with his hand and assuming a horizontal scan expression whenever Tavis heaves into view, seeming to recede even as he bears down. CT as headmaster always has a number of introductory questions for matriculants, and Hal, now, in November, can't remember which one of these Tavis opened with Echt, but he remembers seeing the little girl's sucker stick sweep the air, and a plastic Mr. Bouncity Bounce, no pierce earring, swing wildly as she shook her head.
219.
Hal marveled at her size. How high could somebody this little be ranked, even regionally, in 12s? And then, yes, the sumptuous squeak of Tavis's big seagrass chair coming back forward as his elbows took his weight, and he laced his fingers together out across meters of polymer-reinforced shale desktop, custom-designed. The headmaster's smile, as he leaned back, though hidden from Hal because of the shadow of the office's enormous stair blaster,
220,
was nevertheless audible because of the thing with Charles Tavis's teeth, about which maybe the less said the better. Looking discreetly in, Hal had felt an involuntary rush of affection for CT. His maternal uncle's hair was straight and very precisely combed over, and his little mustache was never quite symmetrical. One eye was also set at a slightly different angle than the other, so that besides holding his hand up to scan, Stice would also cock his head slightly to the side whenever CT came near. Hal's involuntary grin is lopsided and only half felt now, remembering. The axe handle sitting there, slumped with his fist to his chin, a posture that he thinks makes him look meditative, but that really makes him look in utero. And Kitten Plan is chewing at her knuckles tattoos, which is what she does, instead of washing them off. Then Ortho Stice had entered the hot waiting room, shirt wet and crew cut matted from the courts and toting his Wilsons, and made right for the AC vent's downdraft outside Tavis's little vestibule. Stice's clothes were comped by Fila, and when he played any sort of match, he wore all black, and at ETA and on the tour, was known as the Darkness. He had a crew cut and the beginnings of jowls. He and Hal exchanged the very slight sorts of nods people use when they like each other past all need for politeness. They had similar games, although most of Stice's touch was at the net. Stice raised one hand to his eyes and cocked his head slightly in the direction of the office's lamplight. The little guy gonna be a long time in there? You have to ask? Tavis was saying, "What actually we do for you here is to break you down in very carefully selected ways. Take you apart as a little girl and put you back together again as a tennis player who can take the court against any little girl in North America without fear of limitation, with a perspective unmarred by the eyelashes of whatever pockets you brought here. A little girl now who can regard the court as a mirror whose reflection holds no illusions or fear for you."
"Now the thing with the skull," Stice said.
Hal had watched goose flesh rise on Stice's arms and legs as he stood under the cold air and faced up and breathed, hugging his gear to his chest. "One possible way of couching it is to choose to say that we will take apart your skull very gently and reconstruct a skull for you that will have a highly developed bump of clarity and a slight concave dent where the fear instinct used to be. I'm doing my best to cast all this in terms that you are right now, can be comfortable with, Tina. Though I need to tell you, I feel uncomfortable adjusting a presentation toward or down toward anyone in any way, since I'm terribly vain, both as a man and an educator, about my reputation for candor," Tavis said, the audible smile. "It is one of my limitations." Stice withdrew without even having to say goodbye to Hal. They were at complete ease with one another. It had been a bit different the year before, when Hal was still in boys' 16s. Hal heard Stice say something to somebody out in the lobby. Part of CT's impression of distance, just past the eye's focal length, was the fact that the two sides of his face didn't quite go together. It wasn't as drastic as a stroke victim's face, or a deformity. The subtlety of it was part of it, the essential vagueness about himself that Tavis fought by sort of peeling his skull back and exposing his brain to you without any sort of warning or invitation. It was part of the man's preoccupied frenzy. Between Orthostice's exit and the mom's entry, Hal had been flexing the ankle and watching the swelling shift slightly under the multiple socks. He stood and put his weight on the ankle experimentally a couple times, and then sat back down and flexed it, watching the swelling very intently. The way he knew suddenly that he was going to go down and get high in secret in the pump room before showering was that it hadn't occurred to him to ask the darkness about making some sort of arrangements to eat together, since Stice had missed supper too. His viscera were putting out the sound of one of those tea kettles that doesn't have a whistle and so just rumbles as it boils. A competitive athlete cannot skip meals without terrific metabolic distress. After a little while, Avril Incandenza, ETA's Dean of Academic Affairs, had lowered her head under the waiting room's jam and come in, looking fresh and totally untouched by the heat. She had one of the orientation packets in its customary red and gray binder. The moms always had this way of establishing herself in the exact center of any room she was in, so that from any angle, she was somehow in the line of all sight. It was part of her, and so, to that extent, dear to Hal. But it was noticeable and kind of unsettling. His brother Oren, during a late-night round of family trivia, had once described Avril as the black hole of human attention. Hal had been pacing, rising up on the toes of the left foot, trying to gauge the exact level of physical discomfort he was feeling. That's when she came in. Hal and the moms always greeted each other, kind of extravagantly. When Avril entered a room, any sort of pacing reduced to orbiting, and Hal's pacing became vaguely circular around the waiting room's perimeter, as Avril rested her tailbone on the receptionist's desk and crossed her ankles and produced her cigarette case. Her manner always became very casual and almost sort of male when she and Hal were alone in a room. She watched him walk.
"The ankle?"
He hated himself for exaggerating the limp even slightly.
Tender. Sore at the very worst. More like tender.
"No, now, no need to cry," CT was exclaiming as he knelt at the side of the chair from which little legs dangled and were spasming around. I didn't mean literally break, as in break open your head, Tina. Please let me acknowledge that this is totally my fault, my dear, for presenting what we'll be up to here in just exactly the wrong sort of light.
Avril had casually produced a 100mm Rodney from the flat brass case and tamped it on an unlined knuckle. Hal produced no lighter. Neither of them had looked toward Tavis's office's mall. Avril's smock-type dress was blue cotton, with a kind of scalloped white doily around the shoulders, and white stockings and painfully white Reebok cross-trainers.
"I am horrified that I've made you cry like this."
Tavis's voice had assumed that stressed character of issuing from the end of a long corridor.
"Just please know that a totally unthreatening lap is available if you want a lap, is all I can think of to say."
Avril always smoked with her smoking arm up, an elbow resting in the crook of the other arm. She would frequently hold a Rodney just this same way, without lighting it or even putting it in her mouth. She permitted herself to smoke only in her ETA office and headmaster's house study, and one or two other venues outfitted with air filtration equipment. Her posture that night, with her coccyx against something and looking down the length of her legs, was awfully close to the way himself used to stand around. She indicated CT's door with her head.
"I gather he's been in there a while."
Hal despised even the very slight suggestion of whine that came in.
"I've been waiting here, coming up on an hour."
And that he liked it a little, that she looked pained for him, as her tiny eyebrows, unplucked, just naturally tiny and arched, went up.
"You've had nothing to eat then yet?"
"I was summoned."
Tavis's voice in there.
"I'll invite you right here and now to sit on my lap and let me make such soothing sounds as there, there, there." "Want my mommy and daddy?"
Avril said.
"That's the old tum making those sounds then, and not the air conditioner?"
With that smile that was also a kind of wince.
"Couldn't even start to describe the sounds coming from down there. Like that whistleless kettle himself used to leave on when..."
An apple appeared from a deep pocket in her smock.
"Happen to have a spare Granny Smith here. Attack body to soul while we wait."
He smiled tiredly at the big green apple.
"Mom's, that's your apple. That's all you're going to eat between 12 and 23, I happen to know."
Avril made a distended gesture.
"Stuffed. Huge lunch with a set of parents not 3 hours ago. I've been staggering around since."
Looking at the apple like she had no idea where it even come from.
"I'll probably pitch this out."
"You will not."
"Please."
Rising from the desk's edge, without seeming to use muscles, apple held out like something distasteful. Cigarette down at her side, where it would be putting a hole in the smock if lit.
"You'd be doing both of us a favor."
"This drives me bats. You know this drives me bats." Oren and Hal's term for this routine is politeness roulette. This mom's thing that makes you hate yourself for telling her the truth about any kind of problem because of what the consequences will be for her. It's like to report any sort of need or problem is to mug her. Oren and Hal had this bit during family trivia sometimes.
"Please, I'm not using this oxygen anyway."
"What? This old limb? Take it.
In the way all the time. Take it."
"But it's a gorgeous bowel movement, Mario. The living room rug needed something. I didn't know what till right this very moment." The special fantoddish chill of feeling both complicit and obliged. Hal despised the way he always reacted, taking the apple, pretending to pretend his reluctance to eat her supper was a pretense. Oren believed she did it all on purpose, which was way too easy. He said she went around with her feelings out in front of her with an arm around the feelings windpipe and a Glock 9mm to the feelings temple, like a terrorist with a hostage daring you to shoot. The moms held the red binder out to Hal without moving.
"Have you seen Alice's new packets?"
The apple was good sour, but perfumey from the pocket of the mom's smock, and it stimulated a torrent of saliva. The binder had different little informal and action photos from the waiting room walls, and off-prints of clippings, and three rings for the packet of guidelines and honor code pledges, all done up by Moore in a Gothic italics. Hal looked up from the binder, indicating CT's office with his head. You're taking the girl around yourself?
We're encouragingly short-staffed. Thierry and Donnie won their qualifying round at Hartford, so they're staying over.
She leaned way forward and looked in at CT, so he could see she was out here. She smiled. Hal followed her look. The girl's name's Tina something, and she'll come up to about your knee.
Echt,
Avril said, looking at something on a printout. Hal looked at her while he chewed. You don't like her already?
Tina Echt, Paul Tuckett. Father, apparently some sort of unleavened baker. Mother, a public relations person for the Red Sox AAA baseball there.
Hal had to wipe his chin as he smiled. AAA, not AAA. Avril was leaning forward at the waist with the binder, to her breast the way females hold flat things, still trying to catch the headmaster's eye. Hal said, Trolch finally has some competition in the repulsive last name department.
Lord, she is a small one, isn't she?
I can't see her being more than maybe 5.
Oh, golly, let's see. 8'7", high IQ, somewhat impoverished-looking MMPI. Played out of Providence Racket in Bath and East Providence. Ranked 31st in Eastern 12s as of June.
She can't be much taller than her damn stick out there when she plays. Shit's gonna keep her here, what, 12 years?
The girl's father has been calling about admission for her for over 2 years, Charles said.
He was doing that thing about taking skulls apart, and she yelled bloody murder. Avril's laugh's onset was high-pitched and alarming and distinctive. So now at least CT would for sure know the moms was out here waiting, and would wind things up and maybe get to Hal so Hal could go get high in secret.
Well, good for her, Avril said.
The orbit took him around lateral Alice Moore's desk in a kind of thick ellipse. Every time his left foot came down, he either dipped down or raised up briefly to tiptoe, flexing the ankle. 10 years here and she'll lose her mind. If she starts at 7, she'll either be ready for the show at 14, or by 14 she'll start getting that burned-out look that makes you want to wave your hand in front of her face. There was the sound of Tavis's squeaky right nun bush pacing faster, which meant real conclusion. I'm going to predict it's probably hard to see yourself as a great athlete at this stage, Tina. Not being able to see over the net yet. But possibly even harder to see yourself as providing entertainment, engaging people's attention. As a high-velocity object people can project themselves onto, forgetting their own limitations in the face of the nearly limitless potential someone as young as yourself represents. The apple generated tremendous amounts of saliva. He'll put her in the show before Mensis. There'll be another enormous fuss and high rental cartridges of a girl no larger than a racket beating up on hairy Slavic lesbians. And then by 14, she'll be like old coal in the bottom of a backyard grill. Some old military joke about apples kept running through. Eat the apple, fuck the core. Hal couldn't remember what it was supposed to signify. The moms was snapping her fingers silently and working her forehead.
There's some term for coals reduced to residue after a day in a grill. I'm trying to think.
Hal hates this. Clinkers, he said instantly. From clinker, Low German, and clinkered, Old Dutch. To sound, ring. Nominated to substantive around 1769. A hard mass formed by the fusion of the earthy impurities of like coal, iron ore, limestone. He hated it that she could even dream he'd been taken in by the aphasic furrowing and finger snapping, and then that he's always so pleased to play along. Is it showing off if you hate it?
Clinker.
A grill wouldn't have clinkers. Charcoal's refined to burn right down to dust, Clinkers are sort of metallic, I think. See, for example, the ring dash sound etymology.
I like to suspect this is why so many of our older players like to project me into this Carnival Barker persona, with tiny balance sheets revolving in my eyes, that I'm up front with every incoming addition to our family, that this is where the resources come from for professional tennis, and for the North American Junior Development System for gifted children who want to scale the heights to professionalism or to a competitive college career. And so, ultimately, for an academy like this one's considerable operating expenses, and for scholarships like the partial one we're so happy to be able to offer your parents for you.
So then perhaps you'd care to join us for dinner. We're also having Ms. Echt if she can stay up that long.
The core made a very muffled cymbal sound in the bottom of lateral Alice's wastebasket.
I can't get out of Dawn's. Wayne and I are supposed to play Slobodan and Hardigan at some corporate spectacle thing at Auburndale right after lunch.
221.
Have you had Barry speak to Gerhardt about the ankle not getting better?
The clay will be good to it. Shtit knows all about the ankle.
Well, best of British luck to you both.
Avril's purse looked more like soft luggage than like a purse.
May I lend you the key to the kitchen, then?
It's always the mom's left shoulder, Hal looks over, whenever he orbits. And his plans emerged between Avril's invitations to accept some sort of politeness act. The darkness and I were going to blast down the hill and grab something if and when I ever get out of here.
Oh.
Then he wondered with dread what Stice might have said to her on her way in regarding supper.
Maybe Pemulus, too. I think Pemulus said.
Well, do not, under any circumstances, enjoy yourself.
Echt and Tavis were both standing now, in there. Their handshake looked, for the first split second he looked, like CT was jacking off, and the little girl was going, Sieg Heil. Hal thought he was maybe starting to lose his mind. Even the meat of the Granny Smith smelled like perfume.
3 months later, earlier today, before being again summoned, at the dentist's. The dentist's office, it had a weird, sharp, clean, sweet smell about it, the olfactory equivalent of fluorescent light. Hal had felt the cold stab in the gum, and then the slow radial freeze, his face ballooning to become one of the frozen cumuli against the aftershave blue of the dental wallpaper sky. Zagarelli, DDS, had dry, dark green eyes that bulged above his mint-blue mask, as in like olives where his eyes should be, as he leaned in to proceed, his dental overhead lights corona giving him one of those mal-perspectived medieval halos that seemed to stand on end. Even masked, Zagarelli's breath was infamous. ETAs forced for the first time by their ETA group plan to recline below Zagarelli are counseled on how to respire. To inhale when Zagarelli inhales, and exhale right back out with him, to avoid doubling the amount of suffering Hal's already gone through, just today. Charles Tavis is not a buffoon. The thing that's keeping things so tensely quiet out here amid all this waiting room blue is that there are historically at least two Charles Tavises, the three older boys know. The openly cross-sectional and free-associating and arms-waving on the perspectival horizon, dithering, hand-wringing, total-worry persona is really Tavis's version of social composure, his way of trying to get along with you. But just ask Michael Pemulus, whose sneakers have been on Tavis's carpet so often, they've left an unvacuumable impression in the checked antron. When Tavis loses his composure, when the integrity or smooth function of the academy or his unquestioned place at the ETA tiller is, God forbid, threatened, Hal's openly adjustable uncle becomes a different man, one not to be fucked with. It's not necessarily pejorative to compare a cornered bureaucrat to a cornered rat. The danger sign to watch out for is if Tavis suddenly gets very quiet and very still. Because then he seems, prospectively,
to grow. He seems, sitting there, to rush in at you, dopplering in at a whisper, almost looming over you from across the huge desk. If shit meets administrative fan, kids coming out of his mandible-doored office come out pale and rubbing their eyes, not from tears, but from this depth perspective skewing that CT suddenly affects when there's shit. Another alert is when lateral Alice Moore gets formally buzzed to bring you and the others in, instead of the office doors ever opening from inside, and when she gets up and edges over to show you in, like you're some sort of hat-holding salesman, without once meeting your eye, as if there's shame. One big family. The diddle check seems like it's degenerated into the girls all getting very excited and exchanging data on what kinds of animals members of their own biologic families either imitate or physically resemble. And Avril's out of sight and silent and apparently letting them go with it for a while and vent stress. Hal keeps checking for jaw drool with the back of his hand. Pemulus, in a Cyrillic-lettered T-shirt, takes off the hat and looks around himself and makes reflexive tie-straightening movements, taking one last look at his lines on the printout, while Axford stands there needing three tries to work the outside door's knob. And Kittenplan, on the other hand, wears an expression of almost regal calm and precedes them through the inner door like someone stepping down off a dais. And it also seems somehow sinister that she's apparently been in here all this time, this Clinette person, one of the 9-month temps from down the hill, pretty-eyed and so black she's got a bluish cast, with hair ironed straight and then pinned up, and the standard ETA custodial teal-blue zip-upable jumpsuit, emptying Tavis's personal brass waste baskets into her big cart with its gray canvas sides. The way she stares at a point just to the side of Hal's own stare, as she and her cart wait at CT's inner door for Hal and the others to be ushered sideways through by lateral Alice Moore. The cart, like poor Otis Lord's own game master's cart, has a crazy wheel and clatters a bit, even buried in shag, trying to maneuver around Moore as she reverses back along the vestibule's wall. Neither Stitt nor DeLint is in here, but from the hiss of Pemulus's inhale, Hal can tell that Dr. Dolores Rusk is in the room, even before he takes his eyes from a CT who's sitting, pulsing with swollen proximity, in his seagrass swivel chair, and almost done coolly bending a giant paperclip into a sort of cardioid or else sloppy circle. Tavis's window-lit shadow now reaches all the way past the stair blaster to the red and gray fabric ottoman along the east wall, in which sits, sure enough, Rusk, her hose lathered and face betraying nothing. And then next to her is poor old Otis P. Lord, the Hitachi monitor still over his head like the sallet of some grotesque high-tech knight, slumped and with his sneakers pointing at each other in the blue and black shag, hands in his lap. Two crude eye holes cut into the black plastic casing of the monitor's base, Lord not meeting Pemulus's eye, and wicked hanging shards of glass from the screen he fell through, pointing, some nearly touching even, his slim neck and throat. So he has to hold his head very still, despite the heavings of his shallow chest, with the day shift ETA nurse standing behind him, and inclined over the back of the sofa to hold the monitor very carefully in place, the incline producing cleavage which Hal would gladly choose to be the sort of person not to note. Lord's eyes move to Hal and blink dolefully through the holes, and he can be heard sniffing moistly in there, complexly muffled. And Pemulus is just finishing moving his feet precisely into their familiar impressions in the office carpet, when CT, seeming direly to rise from his chair without getting up, quietly asks the room's last occupant, the scrubbed young button-nosed urologist in an ONANTA blazer, severely underdue at ETA, seated back in the shadow of the open inner door in the room's southeast corner, so he's hidden right behind them from the start, and there's the opportunity for this stagey, incriminating-type whirl and kertwang face from Axford and Hal as they hear Charles Tavis addressing the urine expert behind them, asking him very quietly, please, to close both doors. Pre-dawn and dawn, the 1st of May, YDAU, outcropping northwest of Tucson, Arizona, USA, still.
You can't say it's only a U.S. thing, Steepley said again. I went through school when multiculturalism was inescapable. We read about the Japanese and Indonesians, for example, having a mythic figure. I forget its name. Oriental myth. It's a woman covered with long blonde hair, entirely. Her whole body with blonde down all over it. This type of passive temptation, part of it seems to include a felt lack, a perceived deprivation. Orientals are not bodily a hairy culture. These multicultural Oriental myths always had young Oriental men happening upon her by some body of water combing her body hair and singing, and they have sex with her. Apparently she's simply too exotic and intriguing or seductive to resist. Even the young Oriental men who know of the myths can't resist, according to the myths. And are rendered paralyzed with stasis by this intimate act, Marat said. When now he dreamt of his father, it was of the two skating, young Marat and M. Marat, at a Saramee Damhurst outdoor rink, M. Marat's breath visible and his pacemaker a boxy bulge in his Brunswickian cardigan.
Killed outright, usually. The pleasure's too intense. No mortal can stand it. Kills him. M-O-R-T-S.
Marat sniffed.
The analogous part is how even the ones who know the pleasure of it will kill them. They go ahead anyway.
Marat coughed. Some of the insects flying had multiple pairs of wings and were bioluminescent. They seemed very intent, flying past the outcropping and darting jaggedly off on a course on their way to something urgent. The sound of them, the insects, made Marat think of playing cards in the bicycle spokes of the bicycle of a boy with legs. Both men were silent. This is the time of false dawns. Venus moved east away from them. The softest light imaginable seeped into the desert and spread into the strange tan vistas around them, something heating just below the ring of night. His blanket of the lap was covered in burrs and small spiked seeds of some species. The USA desert began to rustle with life, of which most remained hidden. In the American sky, the stars fluttering like banked flames above a low-resolution seepage of glow. But none of the pinkening of genuine dawn. Both the USA Office of Unspecified Services and Les Assassins des Fauteuils Roulants looked forward to these meetings of Marat and Steepley. They accomplished little. It was their sixth or seventh meeting. Steepley had volunteered to be liaison with Marat's betrayal, despite language.
222.
AFR believed Marat functioned as a triple agent, pretending to betray his nation for his wife, memorizing every detail of the meetings with BSS. According to Steepley, Steepley's BSS superiors did not know that Fortier knew that Steepley knew he, Fortier, knew Marat was here. Steepley held this fact back from his superiors. It satisfied some USA desire to hold some small thing back from one's superiors, Marat felt. Unless Steepley was deceiving Marat about this, Marat did not know. M. Fortier did not know Marat had reached the internal choice that he loved his skull-deprived and heart-defective wife, Gertrand Marat, more than he loved the separatist and anti-ONAN cause of the nation Quebec, making Marat no better than M. Rodney the God Tyne. If Fortier knew of this, he would understandably drive a railroad spike through Gertrand's boneless right eye, killing her and Marat both.
The real Marat gestured outward at the glowing but unpink east.
Efforce done.
No, Steeply said.
But your own francophone myth of your Odalisque of Teresa.
L'Odalisque de Saint-Thérèse.
Marat rarely yielded to the temptation to correct Steeply, whose horrid pronunciation, and the syntax as well, Marat could never determine for sure either was or was not an intentional irritant, intended to discomfort Marat. Steeply said,
The multicultural myth being that the odalisque's so beautiful that mortal Quebecois eyes can't take it. Whoever looks at her turns into a diamond or gem.
In most versions, an opal.
A Medusa in reverse, one might say.
Both men, well-versed in this, mirthlessly laughed.
223.
Marat said, The Greeks, they did not fear beauty. They feared ugliness. Hence, I think beauty and pleasure. These were not fatal temptations for the Greek type.
Or like a combination of Medusa and Circe, your odalisque, said Steeply.
He was smoking either his last or one of his purse's pack's last cigarettes. The American's habit to throw the butts off the outcropping had prevented Marat from counting the consumed butts. Marat knew that Steeply knew that filters of cigarettes did not biodegrade for the environment. The two men, by this juncture of time, each knew the other. A hidden bird twittered,
The Greek mythic personality. It had also pregnancy by rain and rape by foul.
And haven't we come a long way, Steeply said, ironically.
This irony and contempt for selves, these also are part of your USA type's temptation, I think.
Whereas your type's a man of only actions, ends, Steeply said,
with, Marat could not tell, either irony or maybe not. The desert floor was brightening by imperceptible degrees, its surface the color of overtanned hide. A saguaro cactus reptile hued. Potentially young forms in down sleeping bags of coffinous shape were now discernible around the black remains of the night's bonfire. The air smelled of green wood, the tasteless odor of dust. The distant construction site's payloaders were urine-colored and appeared frozen in the middle of various actions. It was still chill. Marat's teeth had a palpable film on them of perhaps a paste of dust, especially the front teeth. No sun's top arc was appearing, and Marat could cast no shadow yet on the shale behind them. Remy Marat's resting pulse rate was very low. No legs to require blood from the heart. He very rarely felt phantom pains, and then only in the stump of the left. All AFRs have enormous arms, particularly upper arms. Marat was left-handed. Steeply manipulated his cigarette with his left hand and used his right arm to cradle the left elbow. But Marat knew quite well that Steeply was right-handed. The little wens of his field persona's electrolysis were now brightly pink against the pallor of Steeply's face, which appeared both puffy and drawn. The cloudless sky above the east's mountains of Rincon Range was the faint, sick pink of an unhealed burn. The whole imperceptibly lightening scene of the vistas had a stillness about it that suggested photography. Marat had long ago placed his watch in his windbreaker's pocket to keep from continually checking. Steeply enjoyed imagining that his interface dictated its own period and time. Marat had chosen to indulge this. Marat realized about himself that some of his pretended sniffing was for the purpose of alerting Steeply to the breaking of a silence.
You could seat yourself briefly if you have fatigue. The shoes straps,
he gestured slightly. Steeply made a show of looking down and prodding at the tan stone's dust with the toes of his shoe.
It looks like there might be things.
I must soon leave.
Marat's hand was imprinted with the texture of the sterling's pebbled grip.
It has been good to be in the air for a night. Soon I must leave.
Crawling around the skirt, it makes one sensitive about simply plopping down wherever you wish. Possibility of things growing up.
He looked up at Marat. He appeared sad.
I'd never realized.
0450 hours, the 11th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment, front office, Ennett House, DARH, Enfield, Massachusetts.
Didn't know whether to shit or shout Dixie after it went off, and the look on his face.
One of the times for me was I'm in some bar in Lowell with some guys I'm crewing around with, and we were there with some other guys, just fucking Lowell knuckleheads. You young drunks that are just getting to be your young working type drunks that stop off after work for just a couple and don't make it home till closing. Just putting away Boilermakers and playing darts and this and that. And this one guy on the crew starts making moves on this one guy's girl. This real ordinary looking guy's in there with his girl. And one of our guys starts saying this and that to her, trying to pick her up. And the date got pissed off, you know? Who can blame him? And there was words exchanged and so on and so forth. And we was all there with this first guy, in a, like, group. He was the one talking the shit to this guy's girl, but he was our boy. We're all in the crew, so we all crew up on this girl's date and push him around somewhat, you know how it is. Say he's talking shit to our boy. He gets a little bit of a beating, dope slaps, nothing like extreme or blood. And we kick his ass around a little bit and toss him out of this bar and get this girl to drink Boilermakers with us. And the one guy that was making the moves on her in the first place, he gets her to start playing strip darts, like taking off bits of clothes for points and darts, which the keep isn't too, like, thrilled, but these boys are his customers. It's like family. We're all real drunk and playing strip darts.
I get the picture. Sounds like a real nice picture.
Except when I got a little smarter later, I learned you never, in a neighborhood bar, you don't ever mess with a local guy with a girl and make him look small in front of the girl and then stay there when it happened if he leaves, because it's this kind of guy always comes back.
You learn to leave.
Because this guy, like, a half hour later on, he comes back packing. Packing means there's an item involved now, see?
Item?
A gun. This wasn't a big one. I'm remembering a 25 somewhat in that range. But then he comes, and comes straight over to the dart game, and the girl that's down to a slip pulls it out, and without saying nothing, up and comes right over and shoots our boy. That taking his girl and made him look small. Shoots him right in the head, right in the back of the head.
Boy was crazy as a shithouse rat.
Well, Joel, he got made small in front of his girl, and we stayed. And he came back and plugged him in the back of the head.
And killed him dead.
Not right away he didn't die. The negativist part for me is what we do. All us guys with the guy that was shot. We were all very fucked up by this point in time. I remember it not seeming real. The keep's busy calling the finest. The guy drops the item, and the keep grabbed him and covered him with the bar piece and called the finest and kept the guy back behind the bar. I think mostly to keep us from eliminating his map right there at a payback. We're all blotto zombie drunk by this juncture. The girl, there was blood all down the side of a slip, and here our boy shot in the head. And the guy shot him right through the back of the head from the side, and blood's all over. He always made me think of individuals bleeding in this one way, like steady. But your serious bleeding comes with a pulse, if you don't know. It, like, shoots out, and dies down, and shoots out.
Don't have to tell me.
Well, I don't know you, Joel, am I right? I don't know what you've seen or know.
I saw an old boy cut his hand off with a chainsaw cutting back brush back of the Cumberland when I was fishing with my daddy. Like to have bled to death right there. My daddy had to use his belt. Before he got it tied off, the blood came like that, with the pulse. My daddy got him to the hospital in his car. Like to saved his life. He'd had some training. He could save lives like that.
I tell you, what still gets me is we were so drunk, we didn't even somehow take it seriously because
Everything seemed like a movie when I got real drunk. I still wish we'd thought to take him to the hospital right away. We could have piled him in. He wasn't dead yet, even though he didn't look good. We didn't even lay him down.